Are some sports better than others when it comes to cardiovascular mortality?
Smoking and its influence on heart attacks.
Does a frailty assessment before surgery help avoid it in some folks?
In artificial intelligence, the eyes have it.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 2nd, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And because I am in such awe of your amazing ability to conjure up puns in such a short period of time, we're going to definitely have to turn to the eyes have it when it comes to artificial intelligence. That's in JAMA Ophthalmology.
Elizabeth, I found this to be a fascinating article, and I actually think it's the wave of the future of medicine. It's using artificial intelligence, or what's called deep learning neural networks, to help us either make diagnosis or to treat patients. And in this particular case, using a deep learning algorithm for the detection of diabetic eye problems called diabetic retinopathy. We're both aware that this affects millions of individuals in the United States and around the world, and it's treatable. It involves routine screening. Once we begin to see early signs of it, we increase the rate of screening. One of the problems is that many people don't have it done, in part because it's somewhat expensive, it takes time, and there are a limited number of ophthalmologists as well. So what these investigators did was they used computers to recognize diabetic retinopathy. What they did was they showed over 60,000 images to the computer that had already been graded by over 54 ophthalmologists who had decided whether there was retinopathy present and whether it was mild, moderate, or severe. From these 60,000 pictures, the computer developed its own appreciation of what retinopathy was. Then it subsequently evaluated over 17,000 pictures and compared it to physicians. And what they determined was that the deep learning algorithm was very sensitive and very specific, over 95% sensitive and specific for picking up diabetic retinopathy.
Impressive, of course, and it's conjuring up, and I'm going to date myself here, this idea of HAL, the computer who took over this spaceship in 2001, A Space Odyssey. But help me out here. When somebody has this assessment utilizing a computer, exactly how does that proceed?
One could envision in an outpatient setting, even without a physician, a device could take a picture of the retina. It could be submitted for examination by the computer. If there's no retinopathy determined, the person could go home. But if there is retinopathy, it would be referred for further evaluation by an ophthalmologist.
You predicted that this is the wave of the future. Can you think of other applications right off the top of your head where this might apply?
Absolutely. The one that's most likely to happen quickest is evaluating radiology films. Again, that's pattern recognition. And we have millions of films already available. So we could teach a computer to recognize what normal and abnormal radiologic features are. And with that, the computer could say, well, this is not normal. So I see a time in the not too distant future where a lot of our X-ray films will be read with the same type of artificial intelligence.
Very interesting. We'll be watching. And I don't mean that as a pun. Let's move from here to JAMA surgery, something that I think is really quite practical, and I was hopeful about it, an assessment of frailty before someone goes into surgery and its impact on mortality.
Since many of the individuals that undergo surgery are older, this is a particularly important study. Age itself doesn't really give us a good assessment of what someone's surgical risk is. Not only surviving the operation, but returning to full function after that. One of the assessments that has been proposed is using a frailty index. Now, we could do that with some functional assessment, seeing how far or fast they walk or measuring their strength. But this particular assessment, the risk assessment index, uses 14 questions, doesn't require any functional assessment, doesn't require any review of the medical records. Just asking the individual 14 questions can give you an idea of how well they'll do following their operation. These investigators took it further. They took VA patients who underwent operations between 2007 and 2014. And they began to use this risk assessment in 2011. So they had 3 or 4 years where they could measure how the outcome following surgery, another 3 or 4 years they could measure it after this risk assessment had been applied. And what they determined was the use of this risk assessment substantially decreased mortality at 30 days, 6 months, and even 1 year. And you might say, well, how did this risk assessment lower mortality? Well, when they determined that somebody's risk was high, they talked about whether the surgery was necessary or not. They developed a consortium of individuals that talked about what they could do to lower that. This involved the anesthesiologist, geriatricians, surgeons, primary care physicians, even nurses as well. So they're able to devise a postoperative plan around the patient's risk. Those that were the most frail, it lowered their risk from about 24% to 8% mortality at 6 months. That's pretty dramatic.
It is dramatic. I'm wondering about the application of these more frailty-supportive kinds of interventions previous to surgery and during surgery, even in a population of older folks who weren't considered frail.
Well, even in those, it lowered the risk. If you're going to get the biggest bang for the buck, you're going to target the highest risk persons with doing their risk assessment and then managing their perioperative care a little bit differently.
Excellent. From here, why don't we turn to the British Medical Journal, a study you picked, and I actually confessed being surprised that you picked it, a look at different sports and their impact on cardiovascular mortality.
I picked it because it's getting a lot of press, and I thought it would be important to at least inform our listeners about it and talk about the validity of the results. We know there's good evidence that being involved in sports and exercise improves not only well-being and quality of life, but can also improve survival. But obviously there are different types of exercise that one can do. So the question is one exercise better than another? To address this, these investigators looked at six different types of exercise or sports that were most commonly performed in Scotland and England. And they looked at the different sports based upon questionnaires administered to individuals from the 1990s and then followed up for several decades, and then looked at the risk of death and cardiovascular death. When they looked at the more common sports, there were significant reduction in all-cause mortality in people that were involved with cycling, swimming, or racket sports, and aerobics. The sport that gave the biggest reduction in all-cause mortality was racket sports. It decreased mortality by about 50%. Interestingly enough, there was no significant association with reduced death with running and football, remembering football there is soccer. And with regard to cardiovascular disease, individuals involved with swimming, racket sports, and aerobics reduced the risk of cardiovascular death by between about 35 to about 60%. So it does appear there's a difference or gradient among sports. What are the caveats about this particular study? One is it doesn't grade the intensity of sports, and we know that the more intense someone's involved, the better the result. Number two, this is a self-administered questionnaire. It looks back and says, well, were you involved, and were you involved more than 15 minutes per day? Were you doing it most weeks out of the year? So, well, this is an interesting study, and it does suggest that many different types of sports do lower cardiovascular mortality and overall mortality. I'm not sure I'm willing to put enough faith in it in saying that let's all now start doing racket sports because that's the best sport to lower mortality.
Indeed, and it's really hard, I think, to even hypothesize on what would cause a racket sport to be more beneficial than many of these other sports identified in this study.
I agree. Some sports involve a lot of physical activity, even intense physical activity, things like soccer and running, and it would be surprising if these didn't confer some benefit. Sports and exercise are helpful at all levels, and there are many different types of sports that can be helpful.
With the important caveat that, gosh, you got to do something that you enjoy, because if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to keep doing it.
Absolutely. For example, I don't swim because I don't enjoy drowning very much.
I'm happy to hear that. Finally, then, let's turn to the journal Heart. A look at smoking and myocardial infarction or heart attack in younger people.
I thought this was a really important message. This particular study showed that there was a pronounced increase in the risk of having a heart attack, particularly in young smokers, that is, under the age of 50. This study looked at admission data in the United Kingdom and correlated that with the demographic data that looked at smoking in that particular population. So in looking at 1,800 individuals that presented with a heart attack, they looked at their age, how many of them smoked, and what the predictive value is. That is, how much did the smoking increase the risk of having a heart attack? Interestingly enough, under the age of 50, 81% were cigarette smokers. And by the way, they had very few other cardiovascular risk factors. When they looked at the demographic data, what that told them was if you smoked under the age of 50, it increased your risk of having a heart attack by 8 times. That is 800%. Between the ages of 50 and 65, it increased your risk by 500%, and over the age of 65, by about 300%. So cigarette smoking is one of the most important risk factors for developing a heart attack, especially in young individuals.
And this adds to another study that we're not talking about this week, but that was released, taking a look at the benefits of smoking cessation on mortality, irrespective of age. So once again, I think the message is abundantly clear.
Yep, and the caveat to this particular study is they compare smokers to non-smokers, but they compare smokers to previous smokers. As you mentioned, if you are a smoker and you stop, you can lower your risk of death and cardiovascular death to the same as if you had never smoked at all. So stopping now is important, and people will reap benefits in the future.
On that public health message, I'm going to talk about the frailty study on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.